listeners of the Mad Scientist Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Cogswell, here today with a really exciting guest. We're joined by Professor Abel Mendez. Professor Mendez is a planetary astrobiologist and director of the Planetary Habitability Laboratory at the University of Puerto Rico at Arecibo. His research focuses on the habitability of Earth, the solar system, and extrasolar planets. Professor Mendez, how are you doing today?
Oh, great. Thank you. Nice to have to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to have you on the show. So I was really excited. First off, I was excited to kind of have you agree to come on the show. And then this is sort of a great time to be talking about this subject, because everybody on Earth is desperate to get off of this planet. So it's sort of the perfect time. give listeners a little bit of info, I guess, on what your work is. What does it actually mean to be an astrobiologist?
Well, I am an astrobiologist. I focus mostly on planetary science. I am a physics and biophysics by training. And astrobiology is the science that studies life on Earth. Everybody thinks that this is just searching for extraterrestrial life. But it's also, there is a great component of astrobiology doing science of Earth. So all the problems related to the origin, to the evolution, distribution of life, we can translate those problems to Earth without needing to invoke extraterrestrial life. So what was our origin? How life got distributed on our planet? Well, what is our future? But also astrobiologists do try to understand life in the rest of the universe. So that's why they also are intrigued by the possibility of extraterrestrial life.
Okay, really cool. So I think the first time that I was ever, at least personally, introduced to the concept of astrobiology was actually watching, I want to say it was something like on the History Channel or maybe the Discovery Channel or National Geographic, one of the, some TV channel, where they were talking about extremophiles and how these other organisms could exist on Earth in places that, nothing else could exist, right? So it was something like, I want to say it was like a slug or something that existed near lava flumes, right, in the ocean. And I remember being so intrigued by it. But in my background, I was always really bad at biology, frankly, and always good at chemistry and physics. So that's kind of, I went into engineering. But in terms, I guess, of the fundamentals of what, if someone listening to this was really interested in astrobiology and wanted to learn more about it, where would you suggest they sort of go? Like, what are there good resources, good books? I know you've written a book on this subject, right? Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
I say to my students, if you want to study astrobiology, you can focus in any particular branch of science. Mm-hmm. You can study for your bachelor degrees in engineering, astronomy, astrophysics, biology, chemistry. But then for graduate school, then you have to focus in more astrobiology-related problems. And as you said, for your experience with astrobiology, life in extreme environments is an important component for those people studying the possibility of microbial life in the solar system. So you are there as a biologist trying to understand the possibilities of life elsewhere. But so I said that there are, we can divide astrobiologists that focus more on terrestrial problems and those that focus more in solar system or exoplanets. So I focus more in exoplanets, planets around other stars. So my book is about focusing in the possibility of habitable planets elsewhere in the universe.
So one thing that always kind of strikes me as interesting is, and so on our show, we talk a lot about more of the, I guess, less scientific ideas that exist out there on the internet or on TV about things like extraterrestrial life or civilizations. And one thing that always strikes me as interesting is the fact that when people tend to report that they've seen an alien or something, or they imagine what an alien would be like, or an extraterrestrial would be like, they tend to imagine that these beings would basically look like humans, right? They're usually bipedal. Maybe they have extra arms or legs or whatever, but they're, you know, they have sort of cognition. They have eyes. They have an ability to taste and eat. And like all of the biology, it's pretty similar to humankind. It's just sort of a little bit, you know, they're humans with green skin or something. Do you think, and one question we often ask, and we even talk about it on the show a lot here, is this idea of sort of, I don't really want to call it convergent evolution, because that's not really what, that's not really the right wording for it. But I guess if you, do you think there's any reason to believe that if we were to encounter life on another planet, that it would be like life here in any way?
Oh, yes. There's some things that force you for an intelligent life like us. I mean, naturally, to environmental pressures might not be true for other simple life forms, but true for intelligent life. For example, okay, the problem of intelligence, we always think about intelligence just the brain, but it's also a package. You have that brain to interact with the environment. And the more capabilities to interact with the environment, let's say through voice, if you can communicate by voice, if you can communicate by light, something that we don't do, but some animals do. And you have ears to receive those signals, that's something important for an intelligent species. Also very important is the ability to manipulate the environment. Good hands, good legs to move around. And that's something that sometimes you see in science fiction movies, that's intelligent life form that is like a blob or something, or something right. That it cannot create technology. It has the capability. So beyond the brain, it needs good extremities, good sensors to interact with the environment. And there's also something related to breathing, because they probably and very likely require oxygen like us. And there are multiple reasons for that. Of all the gases that are abundant in a planet, that could be abundant in a planetary atmosphere, only oxygen could provide enough energy for some organisms to have motility, to have motion. So simple life forms like microbial life can breathe other gases, and they can survive because they are so simple that don't require that much energy. But once you are asking for a multicellular organisms, a bigger complex life, even like plants, then you will have to have some good gas in the atmosphere to produce that energy, especially if it moves. So only oxygen of all the gases that are abundant in the atmosphere, there are other gases. But if you have other gases in a minimum quantity, you always have more oxygen available. So that's one important thing, to have oxygen. And we don't know of any animal life or complex life, like we say in general, on Earth, that doesn't require oxygen. And the hint that we got that some animals could do are very, very small, very simple. But as I said, microbial life in general could use other gases because they don't need much. Another important thing is to, and probably the most important thing for technology, is that for a building technology, you need to melt metals. You need to melt glass.
You know, that it is such a simple point that I never realized before.
Yes.
That is indeed. Of course they would need. Okay, continue. I'm sorry. You just blew my mind.
So the only gas that can produce that heat, that could combine and produce that heat to create fire, is oxygen. Right. No other gas are abundant in the nature that can do that. So if this alien, they want to build technology, start with through evolution and starting doing tools of bronze, of iron, and how all that process through time, they will definitely require oxygen in the atmosphere. They will definitely will require fire, unless their ships are built of stones and wood. Otherwise, they will require a fire. So all the TV shows that show you alien life from the ocean, intelligent life from the oceans, that's not good. Even if you have a lot of oxygen in your atmosphere, it won't be enough oxygen in the ocean just to create fire. So that they could have big brains and they could be manipulate the environment, but they won't be able to go beyond simple tools, not the technology that we have, even if they have the brain and the manipulation of the environment.
Right. Oh my goodness. You know, that's such a...
Yes, that's a very strong point.
It's an extremely strong point. I can't believe that I never even would have considered that as some, you know, oh my goodness, you blew my mind here. That's amazing.
But it, that the point of oxygen is still needed for as an energy source for a complex life is also stronger than that. If you feel that strong, it's still the need for the motion of the organism. It needs oxygen too. That's why it provides a lot of energy for fire and for keeping a complex organism functioning. Another issue is that so that tells you something. If you find, you know, hanging around an extraterrestrial being, they probably breathe oxygen as you. They might, the atmosphere might include other gases that could be toxic, but definitely sure. It will have oxygen in the atmosphere, enough oxygen to breathe. Another thing is that they should be familiar with things that we are very familiar, like rain. This is another important thing. For keeping large organisms, you need food for those. And sure. So those organisms to evolve need a lot of food. And so where they will get food to be in enough quantity to evolve to an intelligent species, those are in the forest. Forests are the more habitable place on Earth because they provide a lot of energy. So, one way to take more energy from food, you know what? It's cooking, again, fire. So, and actually anthropologists and people studying this think that was a key feature. That's why our brains got bigger, because we were able to cook food and take more nutrition from that minimum food. So again, fire gain and oxygen gain is important for life. And the issue of having a forest, you need you need to have a lot of water. And where in land, how you can put a lot of water? By rain. And if you want that rain, you need a surge for that water, and that's the ocean. So that forces you, if you want a planet with animals, intelligent or not, you need a planet with land areas, you need a planet with oceans. So every time you see in a movie, like a sci-fi movie, the life in oceans alone, that's not good. Life in living in deserts like Tatooine, that's not good either.
No moisture farms.
Yes. Yeah. So unless others are, those are after they have evolved technology and they visit that planet.
Sure,
and then right. They just want to stay there. They are now handled. But naturally, to evolve life from those environments to be complex, that's very difficult. And they probably just go through microbial life naturally. So even having a planet with ocean, you need also the nutrients from soil, especially phosphorus, which dilutes in the water and precipitates. So you need land nearby. But anywhere, you need forests to provide that food, and that's rain, and that's ocean. So as you see, now I'm telling you that this planet for intelligent life has land areas, has oceans, has rain, has forests, and has to have oxygen atmosphere. So it tends to look not that far from what we know.
Right. It's Earth. It's just Earth kind of 2.0, right?
Yes. It looks like that. But if we're talking about microbial life, wow, that's a diversity of planet that could hold microbial life in exotic gases and different compositions. Wow, that's very wild.
So I guess I can. So my background is in chemical engineering and sort of chemistry, right? Like metallo-organic chemistry specifically. But so I can see from the biology point of view and even the technological point of view that you would need oxygen in the atmosphere to be able to kind of even develop into an advanced civilization. I guess part of me wonders why it has to be water, right? Why couldn't it be another highly, you know,
another solvent? Yes.
Another solvent, right? Yeah. Something, you know, again, something that would include oxygen so that it could exist in equilibrium with the atmosphere. But I'm thinking about, you know, I mean, I don't know, alcohol rain. I mean, alcohol maybe is a bad example, but, you know, something like that, right? Something with carboxylic acid groups or something like that. Like, is there a reason that it has to be water, or is it kind of that we, you know, yeah, does it have to be water, I guess? That's probably the simplest way of putting that question.
Well, so far, we can speculate that it could be something else. Mm-hmm. So, for example, moon of Saturn Titan has ethane and methane lakes, mostly methane. And so you have a surface of the planet where you have a solid component, you have a liquid component, and you have a gas component. Mm-hmm. So that could provide but that will be totally different from life from us. And in that respect, there's a big issue, because just to have those conditions, you will need a different thermal environment. And if you have, in this case, it's very low temperatures. Water will be rock there.
Got it. Okay. Yep.
And then it's because it's also, everything will be moving very slowly. Mm. Evolution will be very slow. You will need to have also... Anyway, the oxygen, if you're thinking about an intelligent life developing in those conditions. But it will be very, very hard compared to the planet with water, because temperatures are so low, reaction rates are moving so slow that you have to compete that reaction rate of biological and metabolic reactions with the environment and changes in the environment that might be destroying, or for different reasons, any intent of creating life and then trying to preserve life in those conditions. So we don't think it's not impossible so far, thinking about that. And there are a lot of people thinking about that problem in particular. But compared to in terms of water, even that water also provides a wider range of temperatures where it could be still liquid compared to any other liquid.
Right. It really is sort of, man, when they call it the Goldilocks zone, they are not kidding. Everything really is just right. You know, it's so interesting because, yeah, of course, if it has to be a solvent that is able to exist, first off, to be a solvent that would be able to exist in an equilibrium with its gaseous phase and its liquid phase, to be able to do the kind of thing we're saying oxygen must be able to do and transport, it would have to be like one of, yeah, you know, like maybe, I don't know, a dozen, two dozen solvents. And the most simple of those is water. It's just, it's so...
It's more the versatile anyway.
Right.
And you will have you have all the problems with solvency. You have if they freeze over, the environment changes. Mm-hmm. Lakes will freeze over from bottom top, not from the top bottom.
Right, which is right.
So it's not good for animals living in those water liquid environments.
Boy, oh boy. So, man, that's fascinating. So, okay, so one thing that you touched on that I think was really interesting, especially is, and especially so on our, you know, in one of the projects that kind of we're involved with, or at least I'm involved with, is actually building something to kind of view the skies and a camera system and everything else to try to think if there is something visiting us, could we capture it or, you know, whatever. We're working on something kind of fun that I think you might get a kick out of after this, I think, talking to you now. And with that, we'll be right back.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.
So one thing you mentioned that I thought was really fascinating, and especially from the perspective of people on Earth who – so one thing I've often said, and maybe this was incorrect actually now that we're talking, and it, you know, it's sort of fascinating how much we have going right for us here on Earth. I mean, of course we do, right? We exist. We've evolved to become intelligent. Or at least isn't at least intelligent enough to question these things, I guess I should say. But I'm one thing I often wonder, and we often talk about this, is the question of communicating. You know, let's say, okay, all of the other barriers are overcome. We manage to travel the stars and we land on a planet that looks like ours, and we land in the middle of some other civilization's, you know, version of, I don't know, downtown Orlando. Right? Like you end up in their city and you want to try to communicate with these other beings that have evolved. I've often wondered if there's that famous quote from Wittgenstein, right? He said, if a lion could speak, we couldn't understand him, because the difference in our lived experience is so different. But in this case, now I'm sort of thinking, well, actually, our lived experience might not be all that different at all, right? We would live on planets that have similar geography and climate and probably have similar, you know, maybe different cultural evolutions, but generally pretty similar evolution in terms of, you know, we would have appendages to do things with tools, and we would need liquid and solid to survive, and we would probably hunt for food and, right, like all these other things. Is there a reason to think that we would evolve similar communication methods?
Well, that could be quite diverse. Mm. We produce sounds and have the capability to hear those sounds. But I can consider other ways of communicating, like light changes in colors, like many simple organisms do. And that probably is much better to talk at a distance. I can think about two different beings 4 kilometers, seeing the flashes in their skin or so, and use that as a communication with boys. That's very limited on how far screaming, how far you can go through that. and probably by touch also, changes, electrical changes, sensations, and how you touch might say something different. So I can think of a diversity, a much more diverse way to communicate. So that's true. That will be quite complicated. So the first thing you have to inspect this alien for is it using ears, is it changing colors, or what? Where we start trying to communicate, that will be very hard.
Mm. But it's a little. But I guess it's a little bit though. You know, the thing that I would wonder is, and there are some really interesting sort of philosophers and scientists who think about language, especially, who talk about, you know, there's common, like, you, one would imagine that if they also need to take in food, that they would have a concept of food, right? They would have some concept of food. And so you could at least begin to create a communication that way where, look, I'm sharing my food with you, so I'm not a threat. Like, it's not as, again, it's not as different as, say, you know, you're trying to communicate with a blob monster and they, right, they have nothing there for you to talk to. So currently, though, when we look for other, when we think then for planets that are potentially habitable, we're looking, that, and that completely makes sense now. We're looking for this kind of set of conditions that we know have resulted in evolution here on Earth, of course, but also just by kind of thermodynamics, would also be the conditions where we expect life to be able to evolve just generally. What are some of the methods that we're looking for those planets today on Earth?
Yes, as I like to say, the search for intelligent life in the universe is a very real problem. Mm. Actually, we know already that that's possible because of us. So Earth is the proof that intelligent life in the universe is possible. So we are not asking for searching for a square planet or something that we haven't seen before. So it's just searching more of us. Of course, planets similar to Earth is the priority, not only because we know that it works, but also, as you said, that in terms of thermodynamics, there are some requirements that end up in that intelligent life and complex life will be more likely in those planets. But search for those planets, we are searching for anything. So we are detecting Jupiter-like planet, Neptune-like planets, even considering detecting life, just planet that are more similar to Earth past, when there was no complex life and there's only microbial life and there was no oxygen in the atmosphere. Okay. So we are trying to search for anything as possible. So, and there are different methods. And since the 2010, we have been detecting, well, the first exoplanets were detected in 1992 from the Arecibo Observatory. Mm-hmm. But those planets were around a dead star, a pulsar star. It's a star that exploded, and all stars that exploded left behind a core. Mm. And we found around that core 3 planets. And at that moment, it was something impressive because, wait. First detection of planets, and the first detection of planet is around a star that already blow up. And and how they survive it. And,
right, yeah.
Yeah, so it's an impossible. Now we believe that those planets were formed after the explosion from the remaining material. But it was in 1995 that then a Swiss team detected the first exoplanet, or a regular stable star like our sun, and the rest is history. But in 2010, we started to detect the smallest ones, similar to Earth in size. and in the habitable zone, so where the right distance from the star that they could have liquid water. If they are big enough like Earth, maybe a little bit smaller or bigger, and atmosphere. We have to remind that the moon is next to us in the habitable zone. And because it doesn't have an atmosphere, then it cannot hold water. So it's very important, the size of the planet. And even if the size is too large, about two times the size of Earth, then it probably will have, if the atmosphere is more than 1% of the mass of the planet, then it will make any liquid water solid at the surface, no matter the temperature, because the pressure will be so high. And just 1% of the mass of the planet be constituted by the atmosphere, it will be solid no matter the temperature. So that's why the range is about 0.5, which is about the size of Mars, up to two times the size of Earth, probably smaller. And as we know, it has to have to be rocky, because the ocean planets won't be good. Gas planet won't be good. Ocean planet won't be good. It has to have a rocky. But we don't know more else. So we have been detecting these planets in 2010, and we know their size, I mean, their radius or their mass, sometimes both. And the other thing is the orbit, which tells if the planet is in the habitable zone, but that requires an atmosphere. So that's size and orbit is everything we have been knowing for the last 10 years. But now we have a shift in the next decade. This decade now is that now we have the capability to see the atmosphere of those planets. We already have the capability of that for bigger planets like Jupiter, Saturn, but not for small planets like Earth size. But now we have that capability. And there's a new telescope, a James Webb Space Telescope, that will be launching 2021, this year. And, or maybe the next year, we don't know. It has been delayed for so long.
Right.
Okay. So, and that wonderful telescope will be able, probably, just to see the atmosphere of those planets that we already detected. And we are eager to know more, and just to see if they have first an atmosphere, as we believe that they should have, sure. and what's the composition of the atmosphere? Water, oxygen, or not, and other gases like methane and CO2, etc.
And so to get that data on the composition, you're basically pulling like spectra, right? You're pulling in this chemical spectra. Okay.
Yes, that only works for transiting planets. Mm. And the most famous case for this is the TRAPPIST system. It's about 40-something light years away. And around this TRAPPIST-1 star, there are six planets, transiting planets, all move in front and behind the star from our point of view. So we can see the light of the star. And then when the planet blocks the light of the star, sunlight passes through the atmosphere. And we will see how the atmosphere of the planet changes the light from the star.
Got it. Okay.
The original composition of the light, you see it's saying changes because it absorbs part of that light depending on what constituents are in this.
Sure.
And that would tell us a lot, because with one system, you have planets that are very close to the star, which we believe won't have any atmosphere at all. Mm-hmm. You have planets about three or maybe four in the habitable zone. So we believe it should have atmosphere, maybe water there. And you have one planet outside, but probably very cold. So that might have atmosphere, but it will be very cold. So one system, many planets, a diversity of planets, that's the best target so far. There are other systems with two planets, three planets, but only one in the habitable zone. So this is probably the best candidate, and farther away. And this is probably the nearest and more diverse to study. It's a full laboratory. We will learn for a lot from this system alone.
Sure. Oh man, that's so fascinating. I'm really looking forward to following some of that data as it comes in and reading about it. That's so crazy.
And not only you will be able to detect the composition of the atmosphere, but if you detect oxygen and methane, that will be something remarkable because that might be something produced by life.
Right.
Oxygen alone, we can. We all know that oxygen are produced by plants and phytoplankton in the ocean. They provide oxygen in the atmosphere. So everybody says that oxygen is a good biosignature, indicator of life. But what now we know that might be oxygen alone might not be the case because we know of other processes that could make oxygen or leave oxygen in the atmosphere, depending on the original composition of the atmosphere through time. But methane, there are natural ways also to produce methane. But a planet with oxygen and methane, they tend to react with each other. And the only way just to that we know of so far is there's a biological process keeping those at a bay there, oxygen and methane. So it's not only then detecting this atmosphere, but also the possibility of detecting life or biosignatures, like we like to say. So we move it from detecting planet in the last decade, and now this decade is the along with the atmosphere is the biosignature decay. Because we are now able to sample the atmosphere and even tell if there is a wide planet-wide biological process. So if we detect those, then we will say, okay, so that might be life there, but what kind of life? Well, it could be just like oxygen produced initially in our planet. There were no plants. It was produced by microbial life in the oceans. Mm-hmm. So it could be something like that. It could be like later on Earth that once we have plants, then also they produce oxygen and we have the combination of oxygen from oceans and plants like right now. Or maybe at the point that there's animal life feeding on that vegetation. Or intelligent life, we won't know. And that's why there are other attempts. And there's not much cover so far in the media about this. But there are intentions also of trying to move the next step forward. Not only biosignatures indicator of life, but also technosignatures, just to figure out is there intelligence and technology in this case. It's not in the traditional setting. So there are proposals already approved by NASA that for when we do these observations for this planet and search for ingredients in the atmosphere like oxygen, methane, ingredients telling you that there is some life, also search for other components that we know are could only be produced artificially. Mm-hmm. Or even silicon in the surface, telling you that they're using solar panels.
Interesting. Okay.
And then, so there are people thinking seriously, and I mean seriously that NASA approved a proposal for doing that. And when we will have this data in this decade, we will search for these components. I mean, we might have also the alternative of technosignatures. So that's the other keyword, biosignatures and technosignatures, any indication of technology. This is a term evolved from the traditional SETI, which was only listening to extraterrestrial life. So you have to rely on this intelligent life building radio telescope and sending you signals.
Right, sure. There.
But technosignatures include that, but also when we look for any intelligent way to detect technology. Like, for example, gases produced by technology.
Right, atmospheric pollutants.
Yes. And
absolutely.
Then surface covered by silicon. Also, you see, for example, mega structures, and we hear a lot of that in the last years. Sure. Because of the mega structure blocking the atmosphere. So any way that you can detect a technology, so that's incorporated in this technosignatures. So those are the new keywords, biosignatures and technosignatures, and we will hear a lot more of those words in this decade.
Oh my goodness. Well, Professor Mendez, thank you so much for coming on the show. I feel like I could have you on for another 100 episodes. And we would only scratch the surface of all the interesting stuff we could talk about. It was seriously such a pleasure having you on the show. Is there anything you'd like to promote to the listeners, places they can find you, other kind of things you think they should look out for?
We have our, since 2010, we have a catalog of potentially habitable planets on the web. It's the Habitable Exoplanet Catalog. You can search for that. So we keep track of those planets that are maybe potentially habitable. And you can always find me on Twitter as Prof. Abel Mendez. And I share a lot of news about astrobiology in general, from microbial life to exoplanets and intelligent life.
Yeah, it's great. One of the best Twitter accounts I follow by far. Always super interesting stuff. And we will, of course, link it out to that Twitter account for listeners so you can go find Professor Mendez. Thank you again so much for listening. We have been the Mad Scientist Podcast, and we will be back next week. Thank you again, dear listeners, for listening to the Mad Scientist Podcast. I have been your host, Chris Cogswell, joined by my co-host,
Marie Mayhew.
If you'd like to contact the show, please send us an email at themadscientistpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word. You can also follow us on Twitter at madscientistpod or at teamgiantsquid for Marie. And of course, you can see us on Facebook, on Instagram, and all over the internet as the Mad Scientist Podcast. And again, our logo is the one with the pumpkin head, so it's easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
If you've enjoyed the show tonight, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where the money that you give to us will help us to promote this show further, to make it better, and just to spend more time making it.
Because we love doing that.
We do love doing that. Our logo was designed by Carrie Shaheen. Our web design is done by Desdemona Howard.
Woohoo!
And our sound design is done by Jake Cardinal. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you. This has been a Damn It Chippy production.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words, a podcast that presents the unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. As a country, we need these stories more than ever. Stories from Americans who have borne the battle, including 30-year-old remastered interviews with veterans from World War I recounting their time in the trenches of Europe, and with veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and from our most recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other battlefields Americans may never have heard of. Hear their stories by listening to Warriors in Their Own Words wherever you find podcasts.